This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We've tipped, but that doesn't mean, you know, it's over.
The new Trump administration dumped Pentagon plans for climate change. It's all a hoax, they said, but climate is a national security threat. Denial is also a national security threat. In these days, when car vandals are being labeled terrorists, computer guru and security expert Richard Power, advisor to top corporations, says global warming is a threat far more serious than terrorism. We dive back into a critical conversation with Richard, recorded in 2007. It is spooky how much this interview speaks to us today. Whether the new fear is autonomous killer drones or city-busting nuclear suitcases, the real mega-threat to humanity and all life in this epoch is climate change. Here Richard explains his journey from cybersecurity threat analyst for major corporations to climate realist. Richard did advise major corporations, and he appeared on TV networks and mainstream news like the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal. This interview from Radio EcoShock, September 21st, 2007. It speaks to us now. Try it. You'll see. So little has changed for those of us who peer into the future. While mainstream media feeds us fallen Republicans and Hollywood stars, this has been an earth-shaking summer for global warming. I'm not talking about the new heat records set all over the U.S., or the snap floods in the Midwest, or even Britain, or even the record giant hurricanes. Our next guest's latest blog points with alarm to the sudden meltdown in the Arctic. And Richard Power is not your average green warrior. He's an acknowledged expert on cybersecurity and world security threats. Author of Tangled Web, Tales of Digital Crime from the Shadows of Cyberspace, a director of security for one of the world's largest accounting firms. He's appeared for his insight on all kinds of national television news and affair programs. Lately, he's been warning that global warming is a more serious national security threat than terrorism. Welcome to the program, Richard Power.
Thank you, Alex. It's great to be with you.
Well, Richard, how did climate change pop up on your radar as you assessed security threats?
You know, as you mentioned, I started out working on cybercrime issues, I would say, in the mid-90s when the World Wide Web sort of dawned as an opportunity both in white hat and black hat minds. And I did a lot of work. I did an annual study with the FBI analyzing the impact of cybercrime on U.S. businesses, state and local federal governments and universities. And the deeper I got into that study, I realized toward the late 90s that the high grade of that threat, for instance, the threats to infrastructure like the power grid or telecommunications system or the air traffic control system on the infrastructure attack side and on the economic espionage side, the potential for harming economic interests of a nation, that these high-grade threats were not taken as seriously as they should be, and I started to look deeper into them, and then I started to kind of look at the global economy in a different way and the World Wide Web in a different way. And if you could imagine in your mind seeing the World Wide Web as a circle and the global economy as a circle of the same size, and then you superimpose them on one another, it's really just one circle. In other words, it occurred to me it was all the same space. So the technological answers weren't enough. Information security ideas weren't enough to deal with these high-grade threats that we needed. Physical and personnel risk and security to be integrated with cybersecurity. And so I was looking at a bigger picture and looking at a national level and realizing that, you know, in the 21st century, national security and global security are really the same thing because you can't have one without the other because everybody's interconnected, whether they like it or not. So I was looking at this global continuum, if you will, of risk and security, and I've always personally been an environmentalist. I mean, in my personal life, you know, I draw great inspiration and great information from the wild places of the world and seek them out in my travels and everything else. And so I was aware of global warming, but I never looked at it in this context. And I realized in the late 90s, you know, that this should be the number one priority of anybody dealing with these issues for a people or for the planet as a whole. And that, just like the issues that I was trying to get my mind around in cybersecurity, it was not being dealt with as seriously as it should be. So that was one of the first major twists for me in the road.
And why do you say that global warming is a bigger threat than terrorism? I mean, we have the Bush government and all of the cronies of it spending billions and billions on this and rearranging somewhat our society, but doing nothing about climate change.
Right. Well, it's madness. Where we just left off in the timeline there was right about 2000. And then skipping past the cybersecurity implications of the 2000 election, let's go to 9/11. Now, when 9/11 happened, people love to say the world changed on 9/11. Well, the world really didn't change on 9/11. Many people woke up to, one, a dimension of the world that they were living in that they weren't previously aware of. Some things changed that didn't have to change and shouldn't have changed. I changed personally, but not for the reason many people might think. I changed personally because I was just profoundly disturbed by how little had been done to prevent that from happening. And I was trying to get my mind around that and my knowledge of that and was, well, what is wrong with these people? And then the bigger question, what is wrong with this body politic and this society and this culture that people could let something like that happen and not have any accountability for it? But then, I looked at it in the context of climate change. Now, terrorism is something that can be dealt with. You know, it can have catastrophic implications. We've made the situation, us as a collective, have made the situation much worse than it had to be. Yes, there's catastrophic implications, but there are things that can be done about them. There are things that can be done about global warming, but it is such a it is of a whole other magnitude of what can happen. I mean, what are the things they try to terrorize the populace with? The suitcase nuke and losing a city. Well, whether or not that ever happens, whether or not that could be prevented with, you know, sane policies and strong and healthy policies is one question. But if we don't do something about global warming, it won't just be one city or two cities or three cities or some limited thermonuclear war, which would be a catastrophe. It's a planetary catastrophe.
Yeah, we just about lost one city, New Orleans, already, and we think that was related to climate change.
Well, yeah, and I think you and I would be fairly confident. I remember about 2 years ago, I kind of broke with trying to get to address this issue with businesses and governments. But, you know, I would tell people in the people who were responsible for businesses and lives and in the Caribbean and the Gulf, I said, you know, let's talk about hurricane security. And they would say, well, we've been dealing with this for 18 years, 20 years. I said, not like this. That was 6 months before Katrina.
Yeah, well, you've brought up something that I wanted to talk to you about. If you give me just a second here,
sure.
I'd like to focus on a scenario developing out of so-called Hurricane Alley,
sure.
That path where ever larger superstorms
right.
swipe through the Caribbean. And the pictures of these storms from space, they're frightening. They're almost the size of small continents. Now, we know the last couple hit Central America and Mexico, but we're holding our breath for one of these monsters to slam into, well, say, the oil refiners of Houston.
Yes.
And you remember after a few big hurricanes a couple of years ago, there was a lot of talk of people leaving Florida, and some people did. My question is, with added energy from the warming seas due to climate change, can you picture a scenario where big parts of the United States South become uninhabitable due to repeated hurricane damage?
I would say that is certainly a plausible scenario for instance, in the near future, for instance, the Gulf States. We've seen hurricanes in places that they weren't supposed to be, and they've never been before, like off the coast of Brazil. We know that we're going to be seeing them in the Mediterranean, et cetera, but where they hadn't been before. But I think in the Gulf, yes, I think that is a very plausible scenario. Now, uninhabitable, you know, is another issue. I mean, if you're rich enough or poor enough, you know, you can almost live anywhere. Because if you're poor enough, most people won't care where you live, and if you're rich enough, you know, you can deal with things. But I would think that it would certainly, that's a plausible scenario. A probable scenario would be that there will be significant economic impact on the Gulf region of the United States and on Caribbean, you know, basin because of such events in the near future.
Well, and then we look at the projection by the world's top scientists. Most of the countries around the equator, they say, are going to get hit very hard. Even countries with rainforest may dry out into grasslands, and some grasslands become deserts. So those experts predict that even by the middle of this century, huge migrations of people could head north.
Yes.
To the United States, when the U.S. South becomes one big dust bowl, maybe up to Canada. Is anybody really aware of the security implications of this? Who's looking at this?
There's what we can surmise, and there's what we can know from open source. You know, the government of the United States is denying, it only begrudgingly now admits after 7 years, you know, the evidence that its own scientists have put forth about the existence of global warming. So they're nowhere near coming to grips with these kinds of models that you and I and, you know, everybody who's awake are talking about. It always makes me laugh. In the United States right now, I don't know if you have the same issues currently in Canada, but, you know, the immigration, illegal immigration is a hot-button issue they've decided in the United States. It always makes me laugh because, first of all, most of these people they want in here, and second of all, they never talk about outsourcing, which is where most of the decent jobs have gone. But illegal immigration, dear God, we are going to have climate refugees, not in the thousands or tens of thousands, but in the hundreds of thousands, and tens of millions, conceivably, in different parts of the world, as you say, around the equator. No one is thinking about these things. Well, they may be thinking about these things under classified labels, but they're not speaking about them openly. No.
Well, the United Nations has put out various reports warning of hundreds of millions of refugees as the century progresses due to climate change.
Right.
And one of the guesses is that most of China will just migrate north into Russian Siberia. It will be more livable there due to climate change. But the geopolitical stresses and cracks and strains that could come out of this and the possible military actions are mind-boggling. I know the Pentagon did a report on this back in 2003. Let's see, it was called An Abrupt Climate Change Scenario and Its Implications for the United States National Security by Peter Schwartz and Doug Randall.
That's right.
But they were looking at the day-after scenario where the ocean circulation stops and Europe and North America goes cold.
Yeah.
That did happen 8,200 years ago, where the whole northern hemisphere dropped by at least 5 degrees in less than 10 years. I'm also looking at scientists like Michael Oppenheimer and Sir James Lovelock, and both of them are asking whether there really is any upper ceiling to the heat
from human-based
global warming, you know. So we don't know. Are we? Even James Hansen warned this place could be
more like
Venus.
That's right.
What's your take? Are we worrying about a heat age or an ice age?
We don't know. I think Lovelock is very important, whether you embrace his ideas or not. You have to come to grips with them. You have to deal with his ideas. And there, a lot of his ideas are very controversial, but they're very relevant, and you have to model that way. If you're really going to be responsible for people's safety, and for a way of life, you have to think about these things. You know, the more immediate issues are going to be, you know, desertification, deforestation, all those things, water. And ironically, many issues we were heading, and I know that you know this, we were heading toward a sustainability crisis, global sustainability crisis anyway, without global warming. We would have had issues about food, about water, about sanitation as the population climbs. Well, there's another issue, population. The governments of the world are in deep, from across the ideological spectrum, but particularly on the right, they are in deep denial about the changes that have to be made in order to sustain our way of life. It goes from the things we like to tell each other to do, you know, change the light bulbs and bring your cloth bag to the store. I'm not demeaning all of that. All that's very important. But the governments of the world have to listen to what the scientists are saying, what the UN is telling them, and they're just not. It's still business as usual.
Absolutely. I mean, at APEC, the biggest polluters who are there, you
right.
know, they agreed on aspirations, no set goals,
right.
and their big plan was, let's all plant more trees. Now, that sounds like a recipe for disaster to me.
Yeah, it's fantasy. It's not even fantasy because I don't think they really don't believe it. It's a facade. And sometimes I wonder, are they banking on depopulation, you know?
Mm.
You know, are they banking on, well, you know, this will get rid of a lot of problems? I don't know, because it just doesn't make any sense. It's insanity. I hate to get political about this, but global warming was in the top five issues, national security issues, that a Gore administration would have been dealing with. I mean, that's at the national security level inside Washington in 2000. And we have lost 7 years. You know, you and I know Kyoto wasn't far enough, but dear God, I mean, at least it was an acknowledgement of the problem.
Yeah.
It was a beginning.
And those were maybe the 7 years where we tipped. But let's go to 2008.
Right.
We'll say that somebody sane makes it into the White House, and they call up Richard Power, among others, and say, well, what should we do? Have you got some advice for them?
This is one of the maddening things about this issue, and I'm sure you've observed it and your listeners have observed it. I mean, the solutions are there. I always try to go back to try to look at it from human terms and kind of, you know, different terms. Like, you just stand in the midst of a city and look with, you know, beginner's mind, and you see everything that could go wrong if we don't do anything about climate change, and everything that we could do to make a difference. You know, every rooftop could be generating solar power. Every, you know, what would happen to a country if we said, as of this date, there will be no more cars sold in America that weren't hybrids or better? You know, there's all kinds of things that can be done. But what I would tell a sane person of whatever ideological bent that got into that position of power, what they have to do is make the psychological change in the leadership. Say, this is no longer business as usual. This is, our whole world is going to change, and the choice is remarkable, because the choice is, we can either make it much better, or it's going to get much worse. There's no in between. Because if we do the things that we need to do for climate change, dear Lord, I mean, imagine if the United States of America wasn't obsessed with Middle Eastern oil, and vice versa, those in the Middle East of extreme and violent views weren't obsessed with our obsession with their oil. Imagine what all the geopolitical issues that you dealt with, that you alluded to, when we have these big population migrations. Imagine what the geopolitical diffusion that would happen if fossil fuel was not the most coveted resource on the planet. And I mean, my God, we're awash in sunlight. We're awash in wind.
And tidal power.
Exactly. And tidal power. Tidal power is a great example because it's so totally untapped. That's the thing. It's the leadership. You have to turn the switch inside yourself. We all have. Somebody has to stand up and say, we've got to do this. And not only do we have to do this, but it's going to be a so much better world if we do than this one. It's the irony, and I think you've touched on peak oil in your explorations as well, right?
Yes, I have.
So what an insane situation. Here we are fighting wars and proxy wars over a resource that is not only destroying our planet, but is going to run out. And that again, goes to the cynical side about the ice melting. You think it hasn't occurred to Exxon that when that ice melts, they'll be able to drill for that oil?
Oh, they're already working on
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Of course they are.
And everybody right claims they own it.
Everybody's planting flags up there and everything. This is the insanity of it. And they will, that's all right, we'll have nuclear power and air conditioning.
Well, let me tell you, when everybody comes up there for oil, we Canadians, we're going to kick you out because we have at least one icebreaker.
Well, good. good. I'm glad. I hope you get it. I hope you get there first. You are there.
Well, we're already making some of the world's dirtiest oil in the tar sands and making lots of money out of it. And
it's
terrible for us. Is there something you think we've missed that you think listeners need to know about?
We've touched on a lot of important things, and what I always try to leave people with is kind of the razor's edge, like in the Upanishads. It's walking, the path is walking the razor's edge. We want to wake people up. We want to impress upon them the seriousness of the situation. But at the same time, if you think about it without knowing how much could be done and how much better life could be if it were done, you know, it's easy to sink into, you know, some kind of doomsday thing or, the kind of fear propagation that we see with the issue of terrorism and stuff. So I always try to remember in my own communications and in talking to other people, you know, don't despair, because that's not what you want to communicate to people. We've tipped, but that doesn't mean, you know, it's over. And we can adapt. You know, we can still mitigate and we can still adapt. And if we do those things, we can be living in a much better world. But we also have to be ready, and then I'll shut up. We also have to be willing to see incredible changes, not in the climate. We know they're coming. In nature, we know they're coming. They're already upon us. But in our way of living and in our power structures.
And some of those things, as you say, are going to be good and enjoyable. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We've been speaking with Richard Power, a cyber threat and world security expert, who now thinks global warming is a bigger threat than terrorism. Richard, it has been a pleasure to meet you, and I hope you'll join us on another program.
I look forward to it. I just want to thank you for the important work you're doing. There's nothing more important than radio of this nature and streaming radio of this nature on the web. So, thank you.
Check out Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org. From Radio EcoShock in 2007, that was threat analyst Richard Power. He was Director of Global Security Intelligence at Delwa Touche Tohmatsu, and after this interview, he was appointed Distinguished Fellow and SciLab Director of Strategic Communications at Carnegie Mellon University. After 2015, Richard became a yogurt teacher when he retired. You can find him on LinkedIn.
Please, please support your local radio station with a good donation. You know print media is floundering. TV has totally sold out to the big corporate machine and they're losing viewers. Nonprofit radio is one of the last stands of advertising free speech. I count on you to put your money where your ears are by supporting your nonprofit radio station.